I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. On August 7th, Missouri voters will decide on a ballot measure that will give the city health department more power to respond to tenants living in substandard conditions. If passed, it would institute yearly rental property inspections. Today we'll hear from both sides of the debate and learn why many Kansas City landlords are opposed to the measure that would affect more than 300,000 rental units in town. After that, yet another controversial ballot measure, we'll learn about research that suggests right-to-work laws could disproportionately harm Missouri's African-American workers. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Most landlords are thought to be pretty good folks, but there are a few out there who maybe aren't so good to the people who rent from them when it comes to keeping the place up. Kansas City voters next month will be voting on a so-called Healthy Homes Initiative that will set up a system of required inspections of rental housing. The city has 330,000 rental units, and an estimated 43% of the city's population lives in rental apartments or homes. Activists contend that about 10% of that population lives in substandard conditions. With us to talk about this proposal are Stacy Johnson Cosby. She's a real estate agent and landlord. Stacy, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Laura McDonald is executive director of Moore Square. That's a social justice organization that pushed to get this initiative on the ballot. Laura, nice to have you too.
Thank you.
Laura, as I said, your group pushed for this. Where did the idea come from?
Well, it came from a number of different places. Actually, what was happening is I'm a part of a group called the Kansas City Regional Equity Network. I co-chair that group. And we actually did a subcontract with Mid-America Regional Council to do housing engagement in all six council districts throughout the city the summer before last, 2016. And this emerged as one of the consistent top issues is concerns about rental properties and their standards.
So why is an inspection program needed here?
Well, we examine solutions. We don't just throw together a policy, but we examine solutions that were working all over the nation. These exist in cities all over the nation, including three right here in our metro. Independence has it, Kansas City, Kansas has it, and Overland Park, Kansas has this same type of solution. And we adapted it based on concerns that arose out of different solutions around the nation and what made sense for Kansas City, Missouri.
I was going to say, is Kansas City fairly unusual in not having an inspection program based on the research you've done?
I think we're right in the middle. I think cities are more and more starting to regulate this industry.
Okay. How would the program work, Laura?
Essentially, it would be complaint-driven. I want to correct a couple of things that you said, because the promo throughout the day has actually said it would impose annual inspections. That's not at all the case. What this would do is allow the health department to do some random inspections, but most of it would probably be complaint-driven by tenants like me. I lived with mold in my apartment for 6 months that was unabated for 6 months.
Wow, that's a long time.
It is a long time to live with mold outside my son's bedroom. He has allergies and asthma.
Yeah. So it'd be complaint-driven. A tenant isn't happy with the conditions. He or she would place a phone call to the rent inspection department, and an inspection would commence at some point after that.
Absolutely.
And if problems are found, what happens then?
Then if there are findings, and they're health findings, we're not talking about I don't get the sub-zero fridge I wanted, right?
Right.
You're talking about severe health findings, mold, sewage in your basement, things of this nature, like really extreme findings. What would happen is they would come back out in a matter of a timeline, like 30 days. They would reinspect, make sure it's been fixed, and if not, then there's a fine imposed.
Okay, that's the deal. Well, Councilwoman Alicia Kennedy has joined us now from the 5th District in Southeast Kansas City. Councilwoman, nice to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you.
What do you make of this program? Good idea or not? Where do you come down here?
Well, as the chair of the Neighborhoods and Public Safety Committee, this issue was initially brought to our committee. It came through a kind of an unusual process because as the chair, normally I would have been more involved with the planning of it. So the kind of timing when it came to committee, it was brought through the health department and with the sponsor of one of the council persons. And so there wasn't the collaborative discussion that normally occurs when an ordinance of this substance would come to the committee. So because of some of the process that went along with that, the buy-in that would have been desired by the sponsors wasn't obtained in the couple of hearings that we had. There was a lot of commentary, a lot of discussion from tenants, owners, stakeholders, and a lot of discussion around the pros and cons around it. And we just felt like you really need to have a little bit more dialogue and a little bit broader scope of how to address the issue. Laura's done a great job of being an advocate for a group of people who have been burdened, overburdened, and kind of ignored, really. And while there are some processes in place, the real issue from the city is that while some of these issues could be addressed with the current code, we didn't have enough code enforcement officers to go out to really enforce it or to really do much about it. And so that's really where the rub came into play.
And the proposal will help generate money to help pay for those. Do I understand correctly?
That has been built in as a result of the discussion we had. That was my biggest pushback to the ordinance when it came to committee, is that while it solves one problem and provides relief to the tenant, for those, and we've seen examples in Dallas, Texas, where the most notorious landlord still aren't going to do anything, or they're going to be very slow to act, and you're going to displace potentially thousands of families. And currently the city does not have the resources to be able to address that. And I'm not sure what's going to come of the election in August, but I'm still looking to see if we're going to have sufficient revenue to even be able to address the backlash that comes from an ordinance like this.
Well, at this point then, as we face this vote in August, Councilwoman Kennedy, are you favoring this plan, or where do you come down?
You know, I still am in favor of a more comprehensive approach of dealing with housing issues as a whole, because we have, like, there was an issue that I was faced with coming to the council, which were senior citizens with code violations with warrants for their arrest. I started Love That Neighbor as an initiative to address that issue. You have other, these little small Band-Aid approaches to dealing with housing in Kansas City. And the real issue is that we need a comprehensive housing policy. We need an adequate funding source to address the housing issues. And we need adequate resources to enforce where the violations are occurring. And so this is one measure to address one issue in the broad spectrum of housing issues in Kansas City.
So when you go into the polling booth to vote on August 7th, how is Councilwoman Kennedy going to vote?
Well, I think as we talk about what the funding and how that lays out, that the devil's in the details. Like I said, this is a very good approach to solve a problem. My biggest concern is making sure it does not upset the apple cart in other areas. And so Laura's been good about talking about what this looks like after the we're assuming the measure is going to pass on the ballot, and how the council can work collectively to make sure, just like on the marijuana issue, we have to come together and figure out how to balance out how the policy impacts the residents of Kansas City.
I'm not hearing a yes or no from you.
It was very detailed in my response, Steve.
Was that a yes or a no?
My answer is that if it passes, then the council is going to have to figure out how we're going to solve the other issues that come along with this.
Okay, duly noted, Councilman. Okay. I appreciate that. Stacey Johnson Cosby, you're a land lady yourself. I gather you oppose this, and I'm wondering why.
Well, I am a no vote. I want to be very clear about that. And the reason why is because I don't think this actually addresses the issue. We have other issues, and I think we can start with the point, 2 points. I think everybody deserves quality, clean, safe housing, period. No question about that. If you rent and you pay for a product, it should be quality, should be clean, should be safe.
Sure.
And secondly, I think that bad landlords need to be put out of business today.
Easier said than done.
No, it can be done, and I think the city has to have the will to enforce it. We know who the bad landlords are, because there are current code complaints against them. What I need to have happen is I want the city to say that we're not going to tolerate this in Kansas City. We're not going to let our citizens live in squalor and unsanitary conditions. And so, for example, I think this ordinance doesn't necessarily address the problem. We're in agreement on both of those points. Bad landlords should be out, and tenants should have safe, quality housing.
But you're saying the city can get this job done without imposing a rental inspection program like we're talking about here?
Absolutely.
Am I hearing you correctly?
That is absolutely right. There are several codes on the books right now today that, if enforced, would address this problem. For example, if a tenant is in a home and that it is not safe, let's say the roof is caving in, there's water leakage, and there's mold, they can call either the health department or the codes inspection department and say, come into my home. They can invite them in to come in and look at the problem. And then if the codes inspector says this is a problem, they can say, first of all, you must leave. they can close the house down just like they would with an unsanitary restaurant. They can close the house down, notify the landlord or the owner of the property and say, you need to correct this in X number of days. And if you don't correct it, then the house is shut down permanently until the corrections are made. And so that is a fact today. You can call the health department, call the codes enforcement department today. And I know of specific cases where that's happened. And the tenant is put out of the house because it's not safe. They should not be in that house a day longer. If the conditions are not right and the children are getting sick, get them out of there.
Let me go to Laura McDonald here, a director of Moore Squared, who favors this proposal. React to what you just heard from Stacy there. Does she have a point?
I think that we agree on the fact that everyone deserves decent housing, right? But where we disagree is whether Codes has capacity to do this right now. I myself was calling City Hall. I kind of know some people down there, and I was calling them for 6 months. I was calling my landlords. I was showing up in the lobby. And what ultimately got my situation remedied is I called Dr. Rex Archer, the director of the health department, and I said to him, I didn't even know they were kicking this around down there. I just said, Rex, I've been living with mold for 6 months. Is there anything the health department can do? And he said, as it happens, we're doing test cases right now. So Laura, we have no authority to do anything other than come in and then we can go talk to your landlord and tell him mold is unhealthy, but it's still kind of up to them whether they fix it or not. And so that was my solution. What I want to say about
so you're saying there's not an easy answer for tenants who are dealing with unsafe living conditions.
And I didn't want to move. I still live there 2 years later to this day. I've been there 5 years. I didn't want to move, nor did I really have funds readily available to up and move my family. I just wanted the mold remedied. You know, that's all I wanted. And so it didn't require a shutdown. Codes, here's what's going on. When we say Codes has the ability, they may have the legal ability to go and do something, but it's shutting it down. Nobody at Codes Enforcement is sitting around their office twiddling their thumbs. They're overburdened right now. Mm-hmm. Those guys have 250 to 400 cases apiece. They don't have the capacity for 20,000 tenants to be calling them. Whether they have, some of us won't have real needs, right? And we'll call for an inspection too. And then some will have real needs. Codes doesn't have capacity to do what they're doing right now super well.
Hey, Laura, I'm just wondering, in your case, did you consider withholding rent and placing it in escrow as a way to deal with this without a massive program like this?
I didn't need the massive program because I'm me and I'm kind of one to go fight for myself. But I started thinking about all the young women I served as a social worker who were pregnant and on the streets. I started thinking about the community engagement that we were doing right then. And I started thinking about all the housing that I had done as a social worker in this city and who I did it for and with. And those folks were making a fraction of my income. They don't have salary jobs. They use fringe banking systems, right? They don't necessarily. So
they really
can't cope with situations like this.
You can go set up escrow. You can, but other folks don't have those abilities.
Yeah. Not everyone is able to go do that for themselves, right? And it usually means eventually you're going to have to move, right? Some of us just want to stay in our house and have that remedied. And I think what Councilwoman Kennedy was saying is we're concerned about displacement and housing stock, right? Mm-hmm. And so we don't want it just shut down, as Stacy was saying. We want to live there. We just want to live where we want to live and have it be healthy.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about a proposed rental inspection system in Kansas City, Missouri that'll be on the August 7th ballot. Councilwoman Kennedy, help us understand here. Does the city have the capacity to deal with these issues now, or is it as overboard as Laura explains that it is?
Well, I will tell you that that the issues have become a lot more verbalized since this issue has been brought to the forefront. That's one. But in her scenario, what she highlighted kind of the crux of how this went, she had a problem. She called the director of the health department. If Joe Citizen has this issue with mold in their apartment, they are to call and report it to 311, and then a ticket is issued to a code enforcement officer who comes out to inspect. It is a true statement the health department does not have the authority to address this because the code of violations that this falls under is in the housing department. And so that's another kind of piece of this discussion is that now the health department is encroaching on the housing department's territory without having really any real discussion about that of how those two departments would work together. There's a discussion that says that, well, the health department is better served to do these kind of inspections because they inspect restaurants. So let me finish.
Well, I don't want to get too bureaucratic here. I'm just wondering, can people like Laura get help or not?
If I can answer your question. The feedback was, well, we respect restaurants, and so we're better served to do these matters. But in fact, the actual ordinance that's before the voters doesn't even address mold. And so I think that it does have a lot of merit to it to solve the issue for certain circumstances. But the real issue is being able to provide enough staff to do the enforcement when the calls come in, whether it's in housing or health department, doesn't matter. And then also making sure that we have proper mechanisms to enforce against the landlords. Because there are numerous cases around the country when we've implemented these programs where displacement and increasing rents become a real issue. And we are having a very broad discussion about affordable housing and housing stock availability.
The rents go up because of the fees involved with this program. The displacement occurs because folks end up leaving their apartments because the landlord's not taking care of the issue.
Well, the rents go up because they're going to be hit with these fees. And
right.
So the landlord, obviously, as a business owner, passes those costs on to its customer, which is the tenant. And so if someone can afford $500 a month rent, and that's what they can afford, and maybe barely paying it, just the people that Laura mentioned, you know, her previous clients and a lot of my constituents, and then the landlord raises the rent $50 because they know their property's subpar and they're going to have to make some improvements along the way. And as it starts at $50, right, it may end up being $650 because now I got to get a $10,000 loan to make some real substantial improvements to this house. And so for it to be profitable, now I got to charge $650 for it to be manageable. Well, that tenant that was okay paying $500 can't pay $650.
Let me just ask Stacy Johnson Cosby again, our real estate agent on our panel here. Are you going to raise your rents?
Well, I think if the depending on the burden of the program, a lot of landlords will. Because they know that there are going to be costs involved, whether it's the annual fee that's due or the inspection fee and the reinspection
right.
fee. Keeping in mind those fees are $100, $150, and they're subjective. So what if the codes inspector comes in and they require something to be done that isn't really necessary?
So do you anticipate raising your own rents for your own units?
Not necessarily, because I have special tenants that I work with. I have tenants that are formerly homeless veterans. They're a special market,
okay.
and we take special care. But some landlords, it is a cost of doing business. And my fear is that this ordinance creates an environment that is not friendly to future investors. We have a housing crisis, and we talked about it today. There's a shortage of quality, affordable housing in the lower price ranges. And what we need to do is create an environment where people will come into that market. Investors will say, let me, you know, provide some housing in this market because there's a great demand, and business goes where it's welcome. And if we put in place yet another cumbersome ordinance and regulations that the investors would have to deal with, they're not going to be interested in doing business in our city.
Yeah,
Laura McDonald. City needs to be more business friendly, and we need to create an environment that we don't have to deal with the red tape and the bureaucracy. Nobody wants to deal with City Hall.
Laura McDonald's about ready to jump out of her skin here. Please respond if you would.
My brother went to UCLA to an international business school program and called me outraged about 3 years ago, saying he just left a lecture of an international business professor at UCLA. That was entirely built around swallowing up cheap properties in Kansas City because it's the wild, wild west here and it's unregulated. And that is precisely why we have absentee landlords. This lack of regulation is exactly part of the problem. And I do want to correct a couple of other things that I've heard. This does cover mold. It's on the checklist. Believe you me, I check for it. And I want to say that there's this weird number floating around, 330, you used it, rental units.
Yeah.
There's approximately 220,000 rental housing tenants. That includes my child, right,
okay.
in Kansas City. There's only about 109 rental housing units. The last census, 109,000 rental
yeah.
housing units. So it's a very skewed number, and people are,
okay.
I don't know why that's number has been so inflated, but
right.
I think it's about the misperception that the health department is somehow trying to rake in money. I
yeah.
absolutely believe they're the right people to do this. The other, just one last thing about codes. Codes has to take you to court. There's a court process in this. I just wanted my mold fixed. So ultimately what I went and did is I went and threatened my landlord when prospective tenants were in there and said, hey, tomorrow the health department's coming out to check on the mold that you guys haven't fixed for 6 months in my unit. And the new tenants kind of looked at me with their jaws dropped,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
And they were out there within hours and fixed it, Steve. They had the ability all along. I live in an apartment complex with 750 units in the Northland. Near Zona Rosa. It's a pretty nice place for the most part. Guess what was going on? They were selling it to another out-of-town investor, and they just weren't
yeah.
fixing anything for 750 families.
Stacy, hop in here.
Okay, I think that, first of all, that all of these industries, we need to work together to create something. Like Alicia said, that this came to us, and it was forced, in a sense, forced upon us. I want to sit down and collaboratively work with everyone in the industry, whether it's tenants, whether it's landlords.
Didn't landlords have any say in what this new program was going to be?
Well,
Laura's nodding her head, yes.
They shared information, but it was listened to, but it was not adhered to. They heard them, but it wasn't incorporated. I can tell you that from talking to my friends that are landlords. We don't think this is the answer. There's another answer. I want to work together. We want to work across all areas, from the housing advocates, landlords, tenants. We need their voices in the process. Let's work together to find something that will really solve the problem. This ordinance, this ballot initiative, is simply not it. And I think tenant education is going to be really important. We need tenants to know what their rights are. Can you withhold rent? And if so, what is the proper way to do it? Can you leave? Can you break your lease if the landlord's not responding? Because ultimately,
it is confusing for tenants, though, isn't it?
It can be. So let's educate them. Let's give them, let's tell them what their rights are. Let's give them more information so that they can decide what they want to do instead of being stuck with a slumlord. Bad landlords are bad. If they rent the property today in substandard conditions, that's who they are. Why do we reward them? This ordinance would merely extend the time that the tenant is stuck in that property while the city's working, hey, please fix it, landlord. You know, you have 30 days. In that time, that's 30 days longer that tenant's in that property, and they need to be gone. The bad landlords will not change. They don't listen to the law today. They're not going to listen to it tomorrow.
I got to go to a phone call here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. We just have a few minutes left here if you have a question for our good panel here. Dean from Parkville, Missouri. Dean, good morning.
Hi. I was former director of development for Kansas City, Kansas in the 90s when we enacted rental licensing. And they've had that program in place for over 20 years, and it's worked really well. It hasn't caused a lot of vacancies of people being evicted, and it's been critical to deal with absentee landlords who live out of the city and are almost impossible to get to respond to problems. And so you have to cite them, take them to court, just like Laura said, you know, it takes forever. And it's been very critical. And neighborhoods were the groups that initiated it in Kansas City, Kansas.
Dean, I'm glad to have your call. Councilman Kennedy, you know, aren't there model ordinances around the country that might have been incorporated here to deal with this issue?
Absolutely, there were, and they were actually looked at. And one thing I want to be clear about is that this has been a very broad discussion since it's come from the committee. We have engaged a number of the different stakeholders for a discussion. The issue is that we just haven't agreed on what the path forward is. Everybody agrees that the issue is a real issue. Everybody agrees that we need to have more ability to enforce and solve the problem. But, you know, the path forward is one that's been of issue. So there have been models like this gentleman mentioned, and we look at the local examples like in Independence, who most recently introduced theirs and the success they've had of that. But one thing that's very, that's a true issue is that there's a concentration of poverty in urban centers like Kansas City. And so we have a higher concentration of low-income families than maybe Independence would, because there's usually more resources available here. And so we're hearing this discussion around the water issue. We have, you know, above average number of families below the poverty level, and how do we provide adequate resources for them? That's really what we have to figure out. What the unique thing in Kansas City, while you can't just bring any other models, is that our housing department has not had a comprehensive plan to deal with these issues. And so they are being reactive as these issues are brought forward by strong advocacy groups like Laura McDonald's.
Okay, so if this thing passes, is there still room to modify it once it goes into place? Is there still a conversation that can occur with the landlords in town?
There is. You know, our desire was for us to do that before it went to the ballot. But, you know, the petitioners move forward, and it's their right to do so. But as a council, we're going to have to figure out how do we make sure that those that are going to be most likely to be impacted are going to be protected. Because this is an advocacy issue, but I'm always looking at this from an equity lens. You know, Laura McDonald had every right to demand mold to be out of her apartment. Absolutely. But there's some landlords in this city that we know are not going to fix it, and they'll shut the house down before they'll fix anything. And what happens to those families? Is there another landlord willing to rent to some of these people?
Right.
That's the other question.
Let me go to Don from Shawnee. Don, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. The question or comment I have is recently I read in the Wall Street Journal that Dallas had a similar situation pass. Landlords were forced to do action, and as a result, they took housing inventory off the market.
Absolutely.
Lower income people were not served.
And that's one of the issues here. Yeah, go ahead, Stacey.
Because I believe this environment is not conducive to expanding the investors that enter it. We want people to want to do business with the city. Nobody wants to do business where you have red tape and the bureaucracy of the city and the inefficiencies that the city has. As I said before, the city has currently ordinances on the books that aren't enforced. In an effort to try to address and find the out-of-town landlords, they have the rental registration, and they don't comply. The city doesn't enforce it when landlords don't register their properties. So why would they be any different here? And we just worry about unenforced policies that are on the books today and adding yet another one that won't be enforced.
Well, I'll give you the final 30 seconds here.
Thank you. I think that our intention is to get this industry the beginnings of regulated industry. We need that here. We know that there's people coming here attracted to doing business.
And there's still room for adjusting this program if it goes into a place.
And everything More Squared has ever passed has been perfected over time. Every issue that we've ever fought with council, they ultimately pass it to, or the voters pass it. Everything we've ever fought to get passed, we've made sure, monitored it.
Okay.
And we will stick with this through time with landlords to make sure we perfect it.
We got to leave our conversation there. That was the voice of Laura McDonald, Executive Director of More Squared. Councilwoman Alicia Kennedy joined us. Stacey Johnson Cosby, a real estate agent and landlady. Thank you all very much for your time today. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue with the contentious conversations here. We'll turn to right to work in Missouri, another hot topic. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Monday, baseball's All-Star break is almost upon us, and Royals fans could be forgiven for being a little nonplussed. That's all to say it's time for a sports check-in with KCUR contributor Greg Eklund. That'll happen Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, business and unions are pitted against each other these days in a fierce battle over right to work in Missouri. Both sides are spending big dollars on TV ads and flyers on a proposition on the August 7th ballot that will determine whether Missouri is a right to work state or not. The issue, in a few words, should workers be required to pay dues to belong to a union? The General Assembly passed a right to work law in 2017, but the law was then frozen when unions sought to put the issue to a statewide vote. That's what's happening now. Nearly 9% of workers in the state are involved in a union. Now there are concerns that African American workers might be disproportionately affected by a right to work law. With us to talk about this, the Reverend Rodney Williams is president of the Kansas City branch of the NAACP that opposes right to work. Reverend, welcome back. Nice to have you.
It's good to be again, Steve.
Jeremy Cady is the Missouri State Director for Americans for Prosperity. That's a conservative organization that favors right to work. He joins us from the studios of KBIA in Columbia. Jeremy, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Valerie Wilson is with the Economic Policy Institute, and she joins us by Skype from Washington. The institute is generally viewed as having a liberal point of view. Valerie, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
I'll start with you, Valerie. This notion that right-to-work laws wind up hurting African Americans the most, what is that based on? Because you look specifically at Missouri in the study that you did.
Yes. So we conducted a study basically looking at the percentage of workers by race and ethnicity who belong to unions, as well as the differences in wages between those workers in Missouri compared to the neighboring right-to-work state.
And what did you find out?
And so our conclusion that Black workers would be disproportionately harmed is a result of our finding that Black workers are more likely to be members of unions in the state of Missouri. 13.9% of all Black workers are unionized, compared with about 10.3% of white workers. And of course, that number can vary depending on whether or not we're talking about the public or the private sector. And the public sector is as much as a third of all Black workers.
You know, Valerie, I was surprised that African Americans held such a high percentage of these jobs. Should I be surprised?
You should not be surprised because of the role and the service that unions provide. We know that economy-wide and in essentially every state and nationally, there is a persistent wage disparity between Blacks and whites. And unions have been effective at raising wages and providing access access to better paying middle class jobs for African Americans than they may otherwise have access to.
Jeremy, Katie, again with Americans for Prosperity. What do you make of this?
Well, to be honest, I haven't seen the study that you're speaking of right now. But at the same time, I think one of the things that we want to make sure that we get to the bottom of is the fact that whether or not right to work is in place doesn't change whether or not a worker gets to be in a union or collectively bargain. That right is still there. That is actually enshrined in the Missouri Constitution.
They just don't pay for it, you're saying.
They cannot be forced to pay for it. And so and unions still have the opportunity to only represent members as well if they structure their contracts in the correct manner. I think it's not oftentimes we talk about and I think what you're getting at is the freeloader aspect of right to work. But in reality, it's a forced loader. That worker actually does not have a choice in their representation either. They're still forced to be in the union, but they don't have to pay dues.
Reverend Rodney Williams, I believe you take a different view of right to work. Tell us about that.
Yes, the view that I take of right to work is that really it is a right to work for less, because what it does, it helps to drive down the economic resources of unions, which gives the unions or lessens the unions' opportunity to represent those individuals. I think right to work is not good for the state of Missouri, because if wages go down, our tax bases go down, we have less monies to operate our schools and to build highways. So I think that Proposition A and right to work is a bad deal for Missourians.
But Reverend Williams, is there a fundamental question here? I mean, should a worker be required to pay dues to a union if he or she doesn't want to belong to the union?
Well, workers, based on federal law, are not required to pay union dues. They are not required to be a part of unions. They are not required to participate in union politics. So our federal laws, I believe, cover us in that particular area where you're not forced to do so. But one of the biggest issues is that when you have individuals that are working in union shops and they are receiving the benefits from unions, if they are not paying, it drives down the ability of unions to do the job that unions have been set up to do.
Jeremy, Katie, do you buy that argument?
Well, federal law does stipulate that, in fact, a worker does not have to be a member of a union and they don't have to pay dues as far as that's concerned. But the reality is they're still required to pay an association fee. So there is still a monetary transaction that is required by federal law, by state law right now, because we're not right to work, that the worker pay the union for that representation. The worker right now doesn't have a choice in whether or not that representation exists if in their contract they have what's called an exclusive bargaining clause. Now, what right to work does is it kind of severs and gives that choice to the worker, says, hey, you have the opportunity and the ability to make the decision on your own whether or not you want to support and monetarily support that union. If the union does not want to represent that worker without being paid for it, all they have to do is remove the exclusive bargaining clause from their contract, and they will not be required to do so any longer.
You know, Reverend Williams, what about the point that Valerie Wilson from the Economic Policy Institute made at the opening of our conversation here about the disproportionate impact on Black union members as a result of this law?
Well, there's always been a disproportionate impact on African Americans in the workforce. What statistics say is this: that Proposition A targets this African American women particularly by taking over 6% of their pay, which actually equates to $2,053 less per year for healthcare workers, $1,936 less per year for janitorial and food and grocery workers. This then forces individuals to make choices, forcing individuals to make a choice. Do I pay my car insurance or do I pay my health insurance? Am I able to take my daughter to the doctor for a visit? Am I able to buy school clothes?
Because their pay goes down, you contend, when right to work goes into effect in the states that have it.
Yes, and the reason that we contend that is because if we look at some of the neighboring states, such as Kansas, Arkansas, or Iowa, Kentucky, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Tennessee, the average hourly wage is $14.20 per hour for those Blacks in Missouri. whereas in those right to work states, the average wage is $13.65, which is 4.4% less for a typical worker.
You know, that there is this ongoing debate over pay here and whether right to work undermines pay. Valerie, your organization maintains that in national studies that control for other factors that can influence wages, including the cost of living, wages are still at least 3% lower in right to work states than in non-right to work states. The Census Bureau, meantime, has found that wages are on average $8,700 less in right-to-work states than non-right-to-work states, at least based on 2016 numbers. Valerie, how conclusive are these findings? Because I should note that different studies have found different things here.
Well, again, it depends on, you know, what's being controlled for in the study. If the census numbers are just an average of right-to-work compared to non-right-to-work states, then that's going to show you a larger difference because you're not controlling for the, for things such as similar kinds of workers, similar kinds of education, similar occupations or industry, and then, of course, differences in cost of living. So the first study that you referenced is actually an EPI study that, in fact, controls for all of these other factors.
That's your organization, right?
Yes, economic policy. And So that 3.1% difference nationwide is controlling for all the other factors that might reasonably affect differences in wages. So that, you know, is as close as we can get to specifically identifying the effect of right to work.
Jeremy, what do you say to this, this whole notion of concern over the impact of right to work undermining pay?
Well, I think my position would be is there's actually very little evidence that shows that right to work decreases wages of workers. In the EPA study, the Heritage Foundation actually did a review of that study. They tried to mimic the study. They went through the same process that the EPI did, and they found that whenever the EPI was, I believe, controlling for cost of living, that there was a 25% discrepancy in what the EPI reported compared to what the Heritage Foundation came up whenever they're trying to do the same type of report there. And I think in the end, the Heritage Foundation came out to say that there was very minimal effect, if any, between, you know, a state passing right to work and not whenever it came to the wages.
But still, so, Jeremy, these numbers are fairly compelling, aren't they, what these studies have found? And in an era when wage disparity, you know, is only increasing on the national agenda as a huge issue.
I won't dispute the fact that, you know, wages and cost of living are different between California and Missouri, or New York and Missouri. But at the same time, though, there's very little evidence that that shows that right to work actually impacts wages and lowers them after it's enacted.
Okay. Respond to that, if you would, Valerie.
I would say that there's also very little evidence that right to work produces more jobs, which is an argument that's often being used on the side of those who are in favor. So at the same time, we can also say that we don't see increases in employment, whereas I find that the evidence on differences in wages and the reduction in wages as a result of passing these laws is, in fact, compelling.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about the Right to Work ballot initiative coming up on Missouri ballots on August 7th. I want to turn, Jeremy, again with Americans for Prosperity here. Why is a state law needed to deal with this? Why not let unions and their members work this whole thing out?
Well, and the federal law, it actually allows for right to work. And so private unions are heavily regulated by the federal law. Right to work is pretty much the only change that states have in making to unionism in the state. And so as far as that goes, though, I think the bottom line for us and why we believe that it needs to be enacted in the state is the fact that workers ought to have that choice. Right now, you know, it's great to say that unions and corporations, you know, should be able to work that out between themselves. But at the same time, in our view, the worker is the most important aspect of that equation, and they should have that ultimate choice and make that ultimate decision in whether or not they should belong or support a union.
We're talking about right to work in Missouri. Does it need to be there or not? Our phone number, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Reverend Williams, the legislature last year passed a law that turned Missouri into a right to work state. So why are we having this vote again now? What happened?
Well, in Missouri, many of our unions and people that were opposed to the actions by the legislators understood that based on Missouri laws, that if we get enough signatures, we could put that law on the ballot and it could be voted upon. And so we received over 300,000 signatures that state that this is an unjust law and it needs to go to the ballot. Not just to be forced or crammed down the throats of the individuals. People need to have a right to vote for that.
Okay, and that's what happened as they began this petition drive shortly after the law went into effect.
Yes.
And that froze the current law, I think, in place, right?
Yes, and now it's on the ballot. You know, the motto of Missouri is let the supreme law of the people, let the people have the supreme law. I know I'm misquoting it, but it just basically says that the people in the state of Missouri have a right to participate in what is happening to them. By this law going to the ballot, we are not sitting by allowing legislators to cram something down our throats. What we're saying is we are going to have a say-so in what happens with this.
Do your parishioners understand, Reverend, what's at stake with this vote? Do you have a sense your congregation is engaged in what's going on here?
I know my congregation understands and is engaged.
It better be, right, if you're in your church, right?
Absolutely, because that's one of the things that I talk about. And I also emphasize to the congregation and to other individuals when I get an opportunity, that this is a threat to unions. For the African-American, the union has been a mechanism that allowed many of our people to get to the middle class. When we talk about fairness and equality, there has never been fairness and equality across America concerning the wages of African-American and other minorities. Unions make the playing field level. A contract is a contract for everyone across the board.
Okay. Let's go to some phone calls here. And David from Kansas City, Missouri. David, you're on the air.
Yes. My call is less about having come to a conclusion about what the correctness of right to work. My call is a challenge, direct challenge to Jeremy. As he speaks his position from a perspective of the improvement of the lives of workers, that's a bunch of malarkey. That man is aligned, and his lobby is aligned directly with the interests of big business. So, you know, at least be genuine in your argument for your position and who you represent. The idea that you represent workers is just...
Okay. Dave, I get your point. Let me have Jeremy Cady respond to what you're saying. I'll give you a chance here, Jeremy. What do you say to that? Are you lobbying for big business?
Well, I will say this, that oftentimes we find ourselves opposed to what big business actually pushes in Jefferson City as much as we find ourselves aligned. There's a number of issues where we find ourselves not quite in line and step with them. So I would say, no, we're not in the pockets of anyone in particular. What we are for, though, is for more a free and open society. We are for ensuring that individuals across the state have more freedom to pursue prosperity.
But Americans for Prosperity is funded by big business, though, isn't it, Jeremy?
We are funded by a bunch of patriots all across Missouri and the nation.
That includes big business.
That advocate for a free and open society.
Okay. Let me go to John from Waldo. John, you're on Up to Date. You there, John?
Yes, I am.
You're on the air.
One of the things that about right to work, I used to be in housing. I was a drywall finisher, and I ran into an old contractor that I used to work for almost 40 years ago. And he was a union contractor at one time. He said one of the good parts and one of the things that he misses about being a union contractor in housing was it brought stability to the market. You could walk into a house, you know, you had a baseline, what the wages were, what the benefits were, and then everybody after that had to work with a sharp pencil to figure out what they were, you know, what the contractors were going to get in the way of profits. And it makes it harder on everybody. It just drives the prices, the wages down, and it's not good for anybody. As far as insurance and a pension, why should you work in a trade for 30 or 40 years and not have insurance all along the way, not have a pension at the end of it to enjoy, to be able to do things without having to go out with a torn up body?
Yeah.
And enjoy your life, what's the rest of your life.
Jeremy, what about that, this notion that a worker might spend years and not have a pension to fall back on when it's all over?
I think we've actually seen that be the case, and Missouri's not even right to work yet. I mean, we've had the Teamsters issue out in Missouri, St. Louis, where a lot of them had issues with their pension. My wife's grandfather, in fact, was a truck driver out in the Kansas City area, and he lost his pension, and his family actually had to come in and help them. So I think that is an ongoing issue. I think it is something that all workers need to keep in mind whenever they're planning out for their futures. But at the same time, though, I think the ultimate choice ought to be to that worker, whether or not they support or join that union.
Okay, let's go to Tony from Independence. Tony, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about right to work in Missouri. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me on the show, and I'll be as brief as possible. Right to work, and it's a union busting mechanism, and as the tobacco company did for years, with their experts saying, oh, no, it doesn't cause cancer, we come to find out, and we all knew it was, and finally they had to do this. Now, the rights of the employees will be taken away. The employers could fire someone, not even have a reason for it, and you'd have no way to go back and get your job or defend yourself.
Right. Let me just get a response there from Jeremy. Katie, can that happen? Can you be fired and without any reason in a right-to-work state?
In a right-to-work state, if you belong to a union and your union has a contract with an employer, then it follows that contract. So you can't just be fired just because you want to. So if you choose to belong to that union and you're under that contract, that's how it goes.
And if you don't have that contract?
Then, and again, that's the decision you make as a worker.
Okay. Let me go to Bobby from Olathe. Bobby, you're on Up to Date. I got about 30 seconds, Bobby.
Yes, sir. Just want to point out that over the last 100-plus years, every gain for the American middle class has been through the advocacy of unionized workforce labor. The idea that a right-to-work law would benefit the middle class of working members of our society is ludicrous and untrue.
Okay. We're going to have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Jeremy Katie, Missouri State Director for Americans for Our Prosperity, Valerie Wilson with the Economic Policy Institute out in Washington, and the Reverend Rodney Williams, President of the Kansas City branch of the NAACP. Thank you all for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Monday on the show, Chris Kobach is certainly making his mark on the Kansas political scene. On Monday, we learn how he's changed the office of Secretary of State. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kratzky, and follow KCUR on Facebook. Earlier this week, two Kansas City writers shared their summer book recommendations. To get ideas for what you should be reading by the pool or by your porch, head to kcur.org/up-to-date. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scherer, Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, Emily Park, and Finney Sachs. I'm Steve Kratzky. Have a great weekend, all. And you are up to date.